Hey folks, I'm Vincent Duckworth. I'm a fundraiser and the CEO of Atreo Group. I also host a monthly podcast about the sector called Brain Trust Philanthropy. AFP of the Greater Toronto Area asked me if I would help them pull together a nice little podcast teaser for Fundraising Day 2021. I was happy to do it, so here you go. Enjoy. Hey fundraising peeps, who's excited about Fundraising Day 2021? Boom! I am. AFP Toronto is proud to host its 26th installment of Fundraising Day on June 1st, 2021. To get you in the mood, we have a bit of an inside scoop. Joining me for a taste of what you'll hear on June 1st are this year's keynote speaker, digital media expert and disruptive journalist Jesse Brown, and award-winning fundraiser Aaron Sanderson, who's also the chair of this year's Fundraising Day. Let's start with you, Aaron. Aaron's day job is Senior Vice President Advancement and Chief Development Officer for Kids Help Phone. For today, though, he's joining us as the volunteer chair of AFP Toronto's Fundraising Day. Welcome, Aaron.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Love having you here. Aaron, we've not met in person, but I've noticed when we were getting acquainted that you have your ACFRE. For those that don't know, ACFRE is the highest credential you can hold as a fundraiser. Before we get into why you asked Jesse to keynote this year's Fundraising Day, can you share with our listeners a bit about what that credential means and what it means to be one of 11 in Canada and one of 107 in the world?
Well, it's a humbling place to be when I look amongst my colleagues that have all also achieved the designation. But, the ACFRE is really a badge. It's a credential that we use to indicate that we are a professional sector, that we have high standards, that we hold ourselves and our colleagues up to those standards. And in many ways, it's actually a reflection of the work that's already been done, the practice that you do every single day, the involvement that you have in committees like organizing Fundraising Day that you can then celebrate through going through this credentialing process. I won't lie to you. It is very difficult. It takes lots of time and energy, but it is also very rewarding. And I encourage anyone who's curious about it to reach out, and I'd be happy to speak about my experience more.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I'm going to take you up on that because I've been thinking about it for a few years. I'm a little bit older than you, but that's okay. You've inspired me on that. I was looking through the list and I know 28 of the 107. So maybe one day I could be a part of that. Thanks, Aaron.
Absolutely.
Now, no offense, Aaron, but now on to the main event. Jesse Brown is a Canadian journalist, media personality, and business person. He is the founder and principal host of Canada Land, the talk show podcast he founded in 2013. Jesse, welcome and thanks for taking the time today to give your audience a sneak peek of what they might have in store for them on June 1st.
That's my pleasure, Vincent.
Jesse, I'm a huge fanboy of you and Canada Land. I first became aware of you with the Gian Gomeshi story that you worked on and broke on Canada Land. In a minute, we're going to hear a bit more about your thoughts on what our digital future looks like. But before that, Bitmoji, man. Despite my mid-century vintage, I'm a huge fan of the Bitmoji. First, for the uninitiated, what is Bitmoji? And second, what was your role in it?
So Bitmoji is an app that's integrated into Snapchat in which people can make pretty good likenesses of themselves as interactive cartoon characters and can interact with their friends as cartoon characters. Turn yourself into an emoji, but it's quite a bit more than that. There are video games where your video game character is you. It's really just taken on a life of its own and has all these different applications. My involvement goes back to before it was called Bitmoji. I'm a co-founder of Bitstrips, which is a company that was dreamed up by a high school friend of mine, Jacob Blackstock, who goes by Bah Blackstock, just a brilliant kid who I looked up to, a cartoonist and a technologist who had this a real stroke of genius and thought in the early days of social media, you know, YouTube is allowing anyone to make videos and blogs are letting anyone be a newspaper, but it's still so hard to be a cartoonist. Very few people actually can make cartoons. What if we could use digital technology to democratize drawing and bring in a social aspect where we're making cartoons with each other, for each other? I became one of the five initial partners involved with that, and it was really mostly just a strike, just some dumb luck on my part to be in the right place at the right time when my friend had that great idea. I hope I contributed something and helped them to develop it and then helped to promote it, my skills being in media and promotion. And later, when we developed an educational version of BitStrips, maybe the most rewarding part of the process for me was I was a liaison with a number of teachers and school boards who were having tremendous success bringing BitStrips into the classroom, where it was really connecting with kids and helping teachers to teach and build learning resources. So that's the story that goes back, you know, it's in digital terms, it's ancient history at this point, but that's BitStrips, which was ultimately acquired by Snapchat.
Yeah, it's a great thing. And, you know, it's funny to about democratizing cartooning, because it really did. I don't think I can draw, but I love my Bitmoji. And it's more than just fun. It also helps in my workplace to kind of, you know, sometimes to just, you know, lighten it up a bit. Right. And we use Slack a lot at our workplace. And so we use, you know, that kind of stuff every once in a while to kind of just, you know, be a little more human, build a little more culture that's not always so corporate. And Bitmoji's helped us with that. I know it sounds weird to say that, but there's more to it than just, you know, funny drawings that look a little bit like you. So thanks for that.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah, that's great. So thanks, Jesse. Okay. June 1st, 41 days from today, 8:45 a.m. start. AFP Toronto's 26th annual fundraising day, all virtual, 12 sessions, one keynote, Jesse Brown. It's been 2 years since AFP Toronto held fundraising day. Like almost every other event across the world, COVID-19 put a pause in people's plans. Thankfully, Jesse has graciously agreed to come back for this year's event. This year's theme is the fundraising frontier, the digital future of our sector. I have to say, the Star Trek nerd in me liked the fundraising frontier bit. That was great. The importance and the challenge of our work has never been more clear, nor the influence of technology more distinct. The AFP Greater Toronto Chapter Fundraising Day will provide you with an exclusive chance to network with sector leaders and to learn from Canada's top professionals about the unique challenges and opportunities in the areas of fundraising and development, with a special focus on digital strategies. Aaron, you are chairing this event. Thank you, by the way. What inspired you and your organizing committee to ask Jesse to join you as your keynote?
It's a great question. And I think there's a number of reasons why we thought Jesse was the right pick for us. And I'll join you, Vincent, by saying thank you, Jesse, for agreeing to pivot with us into this new year during the pandemic. But, you know, part of what we wanted to do as a committee is to pick a theme that we thought would inspire all of our attendees and our presenters to really think about how that theme interacts with their work. Sometimes for conferences, we might pick something that's a little bit more of an umbrella and we can fit in some of the regular programming. But this time we wanted to do something that was a little bit more focused in on the theme of digital. We were seeing trends come up in fundraising and having conversations with our colleagues that were struggling maybe with some ideas of how this digital disruption is going to impact our work. And so when we were looking for keynotes that had experience with audiences of this type, we came across Jesse. And I think the thing, Jesse, that really leapt out for us is you have this real experience with creating and launching and successfully running CanadaLand that required you to think about a really traditional approach, a traditional sort of subsector that could be reinvented with a new digital lens. And so that parallel between how might we also do that with fundraising? It's steeped in tradition. There are events that we've hosted, for example, for multiple decades. But there might be ways for us to think about those differently, to try some new things, to look and cast our gaze out into the future to see in what ways do we need to try some innovation, lean into some of these digital strategies and improve our work. So it fit just so nicely with the theme that we were thinking. Who would have thought that we actually ended up needing to move the whole conference to a digital format? So now the tie-in is just perfect. And in many ways, I think that really verified that we were on the right track when we thought of you.
That's awesome, Aaron. Thanks for sharing that. And I guess that last comment means that this is kind of meta, right? Not only is it about digital, it's on. I mean, it's crazy. I know, Jesse, you're going to share some of those thoughts in just a second. So, okay, Jesse, you have some serious cred as a journalist, as a media personality, and as a business person. From what I can tell, in addition to the solid work you've done and continue to do in each of these areas, the emerging and evolving digital landscape has played a significant role in your personal and professional success. Canada Land is a digital product funded by a digital crowdfunding platform. Bitmoji, as we talked about earlier, is exclusively a digital product. I have a double-barrel question for you. I'm sorry about that. What inspired you to use this space versus more traditional channels? And what does the future hold for this digital universe?
Well, what inspired me was necessity. I'm part of a generation that grew up with a very limited set of options on the menu when it comes to media consumption. We really had to eat what was served by a very limited number of mainstream big media players. And for a long time, kind of the defining inspiration of my life and my work was like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if anybody, same as if, wouldn't it be amazing if anyone could make a cartoon later in high school, wouldn't it be amazing if all of my favorite little bands could actually get heard or played on the radio? And then as a fan of comics and cartoons or films, wouldn't it be amazing if we could just do what you want to do and not have these barriers? And that's the sort of the inspiration that led me into a life of making things and ultimately to journalism, talking about things and reporting on things. The missing ingredient until 7 years ago was, well, we've seen an amazing innovation in being able to speak and be heard by a limitless potential audience. But how do you get paid for it? How does it become an actual industry? How does it become a job? How do you demonstrate value? And we were really tortured by that idea for many years. I think that this idea of like, you know, you can't compete with free, and how do you get people to pay for things that are free? And unless somebody's buying an actual DVD, a physical object, they're not going to see value. It was only when circumstances and frankly difficulties that I had in my career as a freelancer for CBC Radio and Saturday Night Magazine and Toronto Life Magazine and TVO and various mainstream sources, ultimately, as the media contracted and was disrupted and really cratered, and the opportunities for a freelancer like myself, if I was at the time, were getting slimmer and slimmer, I turned back to these digital technologies, which were sort of the original inspiration for me, and was able to quickly amass a sizable audience. But then I reached that juncture once again, which is, hey, I like making this show, and there are thousands of you who seem to like listening to it, but I have a mortgage. You know, I had just become a father. Like, and really, there was no great stroke of genius beyond just saying, well, what if I just talked about this? What if I just sort of leveled with people and said, listen, I don't want to put this behind a paywall. The whole point is that it's free and anyone can listen to it. But reality is reality, and this is work, and I want to do more of this work, and I want to hire people, and I want to do original investigations. And you know, it took a lot of humility, which is not my strong suit, because having been paid to be a, you know, national CBC radio host, I thought, I'm a professional. I don't want to be a busker on the street corner with my hat out when I've been played in the majors. And that's how I felt at first in asking people to fund it. And I've just completely lost all shame about that, because what I've realized is that, and it's really, the pandemic has just driven this home. It's not about the physical object. People want connection. And people want to feel active and engaged in the world, and they want to fuel things that matter to them, and they understand the deal. And I'm not, I don't feel at all, if you hear my early appeals for funding it, I feel so sheepish, and I'm asking for a handout. And at this point, for me and my team, we are asking for fuel to provide a service that is completely optional, completely voluntary, and that thousands of people want us to keep doing and to do better and better. That's our model. That's what we provide, is, you know, certain basic things of like keeping an eye on the media and reporting stories. But we're also the podcasts that keep you company when you walk your dog or, you know, wash the dishes. We keep people connected with Canada in a way that feels more intimate and immediate to them than a lot of the mainstream media that they're consuming. So my mentality towards the fundraising aspect of it has really evolved over the years, not just from feeling that I'm asking for donations to asking for support and fuel, but also moving from you know, mission to membership. A lot of people will fund Canada Land the first time because they believe in what we're doing on an ideological level, but We want them to feel like members. We want them to continue to fund it. We want an ongoing relationship whereby we continually earn and deserve their support because they keep listening to it. And the reason why people stop funding us, sometimes it's because their credit card expires, but then we bug them and we get them back if they're using our service. And it's a wonderful fuel. It's a better fuel than when I used to do stuff for commercial media where the point was to amass a big audience and then sell the attention of that audience to an advertiser. This is very direct. People pay us to provide podcasts for as long as they find those podcasts valuable and interesting. And if they stop listening to the podcast, and there certainly are many other podcasts out there for them to listen to, including this one, it's only a matter of time before somebody looks at the bill and says, why are we giving this guy $5 a month or $10 a month? And I lose that listener. So it puts the right kind of pressure on me and my colleagues. We have to be valuable. We have to do our jobs. We have to be of service.
That's awesome. Well, welcome to our life, Jesse. When you said, you felt like you had your hand out a little sheepish. I mean, every fundraiser at some point in their life probably had that thing to cross over. So that's awesome. I love that it was out of necessity. Aaron, I'm sure you were, I saw you nodding your head. I saw you started thinking about some things. Of course, people who are listening were on video, so we can see each other. Too bad for you. Aaron, what would you ask Jesse? What's your follow-up to that?
I was nodding because I was feeling that the parallels are totally there with our everyday work, and this idea of continually to earn that contribution is something that I think that will speak to many of us in the sector about the way we steward that support and we continue that engagement. And as I'm thinking about this, Jesse, I have to think that this launching into this new model, it's took great courage. It must have. Will it work? Will they come? Will the funders come? And we tend to be, I think, the charitable sector in Canada, fairly risk averse. But I do think there's real appetite for exploring more with regards to new digital strategies and the ways that we engage with our supporters. So maybe you can just harness a little bit of that risk-taking and that courage that you found when you were launching in. And what advice would you give to folks like me that have the appetite but then need to make the leap?
Well, first of all, it's ironic that you're asking me these questions and I'll be speaking to your group because I've learned so much from the practices that have been developed. My fundraisers, the concept of stewardship was completely foreign to me until launching this business and realizing what it takes after the miracle that people actually showed up and opened up their wallets. Well, how do I keep them around? And I learned about stewardship. I think that the risk factor was one that, again, out of necessity, basically I got to a point where I wanted to cover a new area. I wanted to cover the media itself. I pitched media shows to producers and editors who I had good relationships with. I pitched a column to different newspaper editors. And for a lot of reasons that I think have to do with an unwillingness to scrutinize ourselves in the Canadian media, I didn't get anywhere with it. And eventually, I couldn't get over this idea that this is what I want to cover. And my wife said, you either need to just do this or shut up about it. The risk factor was there, and it took me longer than it should have. And of course, that fear that we were going to be one of those crowdfunding campaigns where you make your passionate plea, and this is what I want to do, and please support me. And then you have set a goal of, whatever it might be, $1,000 a month, and you get $18, and you know that it's my uncle who gave it to me out of pity. That kept me up at night, and fear, that kept me from doing it for far too long. So it was a leap of faith, but I think it really is, I think a lot of encouragement and inspiration from the fact that things really can change, and we're seeing a normalization of behaviors that I think is really of relevance, and maybe where the kind of cycle kind of loops on itself, and I can maybe have something to offer to groups that are kind of familiar with more institutional sorts of donation support. I think there is a wide-scale rethink of what it means to fund, what it means to support. I think that as the internet destroys all lines and barriers, the line between institutional nonprofits and charities or just kind of giving a tax time versus somebody has a great product but they need some seed money, sure, let me give them $10. Somebody hits some misfortune or we hear a news story and all of a sudden people are getting active as news readers and moving from that news story to like, let me give that family a little bit of money and help them out. People fundraise for their own education. This is a two-way street. These things are happening and those behaviors are getting normalized. because people want to be involved in other people's lives. People want to be involved in fueling worthy projects. And we are seeing maybe a bit of a decay in faith in a lot of traditional institutions. And people are forming ad hoc efforts to solve problems quickly. And, you know, we see wonderful little kind of wildcat projects break out where somebody has an idea and says, this is what I need to make it happen. And other people love the idea of being one of the first 50 people to make it happen. That's not going to stop. That's not going to stop. What is, I think, maybe a challenge is there is a finite amount of money that we all have. We were terrified when the pandemic hit that we would be the first thing that people would strike from their budgets. Everybody was tightening their belts. And I know that the charitable sector really faced these same pressures. We saw our subscription rates go up sharply because we turned our organization's attention to how can we serve and pivot to serve during the pandemic. And we did not openly, aggressively solicit, but people saw value in what we were doing, and we saw that go up, even as our advertising business went significantly down because of those economic pressures. Our funders saved us. So I think there are lessons there, and I think that there is a reason to experiment, to be bold. I don't think failure is as consequential. It keeps us up at night. We are terrified of failure. We shouldn't be. It's okay to fail. But I also think that there are insights into, I've looked at other people use the same fundraising platforms as CanadaLand, and it's been my business to make a study of which projects work and which ones don't and why. Which I hope to get into in a bit more detail in my talk, but there are some strategies to this, and you know, I've been refining it over the years of how to talk to our listeners to either get them after years of listening but not supporting to become a supporter, how to get supporters to go become evangelists and spread the word to other people, how to get a $1 a month supporter to become a $5 a month supporter, and it has a lot to do with being real. It has a lot to do with making promises that we can keep. Offering things. Sometimes, you know, in the early days, I thought we always had to be offering some new amazing project, you know, in order to inspire people to give more. And then we had to go and actually do those projects. And sometimes we were guessing at how much funding they needed and we would get the guess wrong. At a certain point, I said, you know what, I'm not going to promise you a wonderful new shiny project this year. We actually need to increase our funding just to give people raises and to hire more people here and to support what we're already doing. That was a big leap of faith, but I didn't know if people, well, you're already doing this show. Why should I pay you to do what you're already doing? People understood that because we needed it. I think the honesty of that came through.
Well, that's great. Thanks for that question, Aaron. And Jesse, thanks for admitting that you learned about stewardship and also apparently mission creep and how to fix that. So that's awesome. And thanks for the tease about what they're going to hear, because I know I want to hear what you have to say about, you know, how to turn a $1 subscriber into a $5 one. So that was awesome. Thanks for sharing just a bit about what we'll be treated to on June 1st. You've both been great guests. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Jesse. Before we go, I want to give each of you a minute to share with our listeners what you want them to know, to think about, or to do between now and June 1st. And Jesse, we're going to start with you. What do you want our listeners to think about between now and June 1st?
Well, selfishly, I want them to think about some challenging questions because my favorite part is when people ask me tough questions, and I often come out of that having not just spoken but learned something. So, you know, we're all appealing to people in different ways for different reasons, and I think we all have things to teach each other. So I'm looking forward to that part of the process, and I'd love it if people could put some thought into what they want to talk with me about.
Right, the tough questions. Thanks, Jesse, for that. Aaron, what about you?
I have two, and they're not totally related. I think the first is that I have, and the committee has the recognition that this has been a tough time for lots of our colleagues. And so my first hope is that you will take a moment to connect with someone. Maybe it's someone you met at a conference, an AFP event last year. Just check in to see how they're doing. I think that the more we support each other, the better we will all emerge from this. And so that's one of my hopes. And I think Fundraising Day will be a great moment for you to be able to continue to do that. The second is that I'm hopeful that our attendees will be able to separate themselves from the hustle and the bustle of their everyday. And I know that those days are past. And just carve out a little space to dream about the future. What does digital and fundraising look like 3 years from now, 10 years from now, and to come with some wacky ideas, because once we're in session together during that day, to Jesse's point, it's not just about the presenters, although that's very important. It's also about the discussion. It's about the questions too. And I think that if you come with some of that prepared and you can offer some of that during those sessions, we will have a very rich day full of lots of wonderful ideas. So those are my two requests, Vincent.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you again for volunteering and stepping up and for your whole committee. Jesse, thank you for helping democratize journalism. It's super important. And as you see, people are subscribing. So that's great. This has been terrific. I know you all want more. I want more. You know what to do. Yes, that's right. You need to visit AFP Toronto website, AFP Greater Toronto Area website, and register for Fundraising Day 2021. We hope to see you all there.